We believe that alcoholism is a disease and that Alcoholics Anonymous is one solution to that disease. I'm here to bring you the voices of its members. Everyone that comes on the show, including myself, is an active member and has found recovery in the rooms of AA. As you listen, please take what works for you and leave the rest.
My name is Hannah, and I am an alcoholic. Thank you, Tara, for having me on this Saturday morning. I just want to take a moment of silence for the alcoholic who still suffers both in and out of these rooms. Again, my name is Hannah, and I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is May 16th, 2010. I have a home group in Los Angeles, Melrose and Mansfield. It's been my home group for 13 years, and I had a sponsor. My sponsor has a sponsor, and my sponsor knows she's my sponsor. I say that because when I first came into the rooms, I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I chose a sponsor that didn't have a sponsor. So I will start by saying that my introduction to AA in terms of sponsorship was rocky. However, it was a testament to the fellowship and the people around that until I found a sponsor that was grounded in the program, I was able to stay sober. I like to take a moment from the beginning, always when I speak to the alcoholic, both in and out of these rooms, because I'm a big AA cheerleader. It doesn't mean I go around shouting about it. However, I love this program. It has not only saved my life, it has given me a life. And as I say that, you know, I just get teared up. Mainly because of gratitude and what this program has given me. Last month, my cousin's son, who was 32 years old, passed of this disease. And the year before, my aunt's son passed from this disease. I don't take this program lightly. I'm very grateful that since I've come into the program, I've stayed in the middle. And it's because of the people in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that I've stayed in the middle. I don't want to go anywhere else. So if you're new, hang on. Keep coming back. Grab onto someone. When I came in, I didn't know what anyone was talking about. I didn't even know, when I looked at the steps and the traditions, I was like, no, I'm not doing, there was so much of it I wasn't open to doing. However, the one thing I did, and I'm saying this for anyone who is new, the one thing that I did is I kept coming back. I kept coming back, and I can't stress that enough, because what that did is it allowed me to settle in. It allowed me to start hearing things. It allowed me to start getting to know people and let people know me. I came into the program when I was 39 years old. I had never tried to get sober before that point. And during those periods, the depression and the anxiety, the terror within of loneliness was so gripping. Alcohol, it's what brought me to my bottom. And it's interesting when oftentimes we hear about what was your bottom. My whole experience was a bottom. That really speaks to just how hard it was to, just how gripping this disease is, that the bottom was all of those years, yet not drinking, not using, was just not an option. It wasn't an option because the terror was so gripping, that anxiety, that self-loathing, even though when I was drinking and using, it was also there. I didn't start, my ism started what I believe is to be a very young age. At the age of 6 is my first memory of it. My first ism was stealing. And much like in my later years with using and drinking, it didn't matter the consequences. I felt entitled. I suppose it was a form of a high, and I wanted what I wanted. And I remember the first time I got taken home in a cop car, I was 9, and I had stolen pink ballet tights and chocolate bars. And I stole all the way up until I came into the program. And I say that as my first ism because I really think it was, I hear that often in the rooms, that the ism manifests long before the actual, I'll stick to alcohol, but when I say alcohol, I mean alcoholism, all of those things. So again, back to stealing and the consequences. Yeah, so I didn't really start, my active alcoholism didn't really start until I was 24. I had moved to Los Angeles. And oh, just to back up a moment with my childhood. Yeah, I often hear in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, other people say as well that they felt different, that they felt less than, that they felt that something was innately wrong. And I felt that from the youngest age I can remember. There was a lot of chaos growing up. Grew up in a very bohemian family that moved around a lot. I grew up with my father. My mother left when I was 2. There was a lot of, I'm not sure if it's about growing up with artist parents, but there was love. However, their art was the primary focus. And what that looked like is I was really off on my own much of the time. Only in more recent times have I started to share this as part of my story because I realize it is important and it's also a testament to how much recovery is possible. That when I was 6, I was kidnapped from a park by a stranger, and he told me that if I ever told anyone, he would kill me. And he asked me if I knew how babies were made. Obviously, I'm here today to talk about my story, share it. And what happened with that experience is I got in trouble for that. And I internalized it as that I did something wrong, that there's something wrong with me, and it silenced my voice. And I think a lot of my using was directed at myself, that self-hatred. And I never thought it was possible to become someone that didn't hate herself ever. And I can say today that I don't hate myself. And that's one of the biggest gifts of this program. So backing up for a moment again to when I was 24 and moved to Los Angeles, I was stripping with my little sister and we got into crystal meth to lose weight. I will say that set things off for me. And that it was on for me. And what that looked like was, we did it to lose weight. That was our intention. Fortunately, we didn't lose weight, which is just unheard of. So I didn't go back, even though it ignited the it ignited something in me until I was probably 28, 29. And I was off and running. And I was a daily user until I was probably about 36 years old. And it was a very, very dark existence. Again, filled with self-hatred, filled with just a sense of absolute despair. It was not the woman that I had imagined myself to be. And I think it's important for me to share that I was 30, 36, and that I began drinking when I put down crystal meth. And I share that because for me, it's all the same. Whatever substance it is, it's under the, it's under the ism, the alcoholism. And I had never been a drinker. I couldn't finish a glass of wine. However, when I quit crystal meth, which happened in a day when I'll never forget the day. When I was on meth, I really liked to garden, and I hate gardening. So I particularly like bougainvilleas. And I'll never forget that day. I was in the bougainvillea bushes where I was living, and I had been in those bushes in my nightgown, bare arms, bare feet, bare hands, wrestling with the weeds, like pulling at one. I would be telling myself, you got to go in and get some water. You got to go in and pee. But I was so driven. You know, I was in such a delusion of some sort that I stayed out there all day, wrestling with the vines. And I mean, trying to garden, right? And it, for anyone who doesn't know, bougainvilleas are very thorny. And at one point I did, towards the end of the day, I did break myself away from it. And I remember going into the bathroom, looking at myself in the mirror, and it looked like a tiger hide. It looked like I had been in the jungle. I was all torn up, red, like streaks up and down my arms of, just my hands, my body. It looked like I had been, attacked by like a tiger or something. And I just remember, pretty much collapsing on that pink tile floor. And that's something greater than myself. That was the end for me with crystal meth. However, like I said, I had never been a drinker at that point. I remember the drinking started. It was so gripping. And it's often talked about this disease as cunning, baffling, and powerful. Within months, I was drinking bottles of wine. That scared me. That scared me because I saw that I was in the same place as I was with crystal meth, and that it was the same thing, and that I would spend the next decade, if I was lucky, if I didn't die before then or longer, doing exactly what I had been doing with meth. And I had been seeing a therapist at that time, and I'll share a clip of what the drinking looked like. For anyone who's listening, it's July 8th, so just 4 days after July 4th. So I have the memory of my last July 4th not sober. I was camping with my boyfriend at the time. I had brought a mango and two bottles of wine. We had gotten in a fight. He said I just remember him saying how irritating I was when I was drinking, and got in a fight about that because I didn't think I was, of course. Thought I was very charming. And I remember wandering off the campground, and I was drunk. Hours later, I was lost. I was lost in that mountain. It must have been midnight, and I was going around in circles. I started hearing coyotes. I was wearing shorts. I was getting cold, drunk, and lost in the mountains. Canine police ended up finding me and bringing me back. that's one example of what my drinking looked like. There's many more. The drinking also brought me to a place of, I had been working surprisingly at a law school. I can't believe I wasn't fired. And it was very hard, as one can imagine, to show up to work drunk. And my sister and I thought that we would place an ad in Craigslist to be dominatrix foot fetish sisters. So I share that because that was right before I came into the program. That was my best thinking, to quit the job at the law school and to become a foot fetish dominatrix team with my sister. Fortunately, that did not work out. At the time, I was in therapy. And I remember seeing this therapist. I had switched therapists. And this was early on in seeing her, maybe a month or two. And I remember coming in one day, I would drink right before therapy because that's what I would do. It was 11 a.m. and I would go into the bathrooms and go into the bathroom right before in her office and drink. And I remember one day coming in and she said, "Hannah, if you keep coming in like this, we can't do the work." And there was that moment of grace. There was that moment that I knew I couldn't keep doing what I was doing. I didn't want to lose her as a therapist. I had grown attached to her very quickly. And I also knew I had a problem. I knew that my life was unmanageable and that I was powerless. The next day, I came into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I still remember that meeting. It was two blocks from where I lived. I think I had called central office and they told me about the nearest meeting. It was a Wednesday morning at 10 a.m. and it was a kitchen table, big book study. It was upstairs at this church where my home group is now to this day, 13 years later. And I raised my hand. I couldn't speak. I was crying so hard, but I raised my hand to identify as an alcoholic. And that first step where it says about being powerless and our lives are unmanageable, that spoke to me. I had always felt powerless and I had always felt that my life was unmanageable. And that began my journey in the program. I'm very fortunate that I have always gone towards the love. And that this program and the people in it, in my higher power, have held me. My sobriety has been slow, very, very slow. However, I feel that I was given a strong foundation despite the rocky beginning. What I did in the beginning is I had a home group at the time. It was at the LGBT center. That's what it was called at the time. And I would go there. I would walk there 5 nights a week up on Santa Monica Boulevard in Hollywood. And I claimed my seat. And again, going back to the beginning of my share, I didn't know what anyone was talking about. I didn't know anything about AA. But I kept coming back. And the people in the program put their arms around me and said, "Everything's going to be okay." And everything did not feel okay. It never felt like it was going to be okay. But I held on to that. And to this day, sometimes still things don't feel like they're going to be okay. But I remember that. I remember those old timers that would come up to me and give me a hug. And I remember this woman, she had long purple nails and purple hair and a very deep voice. And she said, "Honey, you never have to drink or use again, no matter what." And I'll never forget that because no one had ever said anything to me like that before. It was all these all these moments, all these slogans, all the love, all the direction that kept me coming back. I got commitments. I ended up getting a solid sponsor who started me on the steps. And I put myself, or people in the program, put me in the middle. And I had that gift of desperation. I didn't want to go back to where I had been. In the beginning, there was no pink clouds. That was not my experience. The depression was gripping. The cravings, they were there. They were not lifted. And I share that because it's a testament, again, to what we can get through, or what I was able to, because of all of you. I'll never forget, I had 3 days sober. 3 days sober, I remember sitting in the meeting, again, at my home group at the LGBT center. And I didn't know how I was going to get my head to the pillow sober that night. I didn't think I could do it. And there was someone that came up to me after, and he had 7 days of sobriety. And he put his arms around me, gave me a hug, and he said, "You can do it." And that hug, that newcomer with 7 days sober, helped me get to day number 4. I share that because it's an example of how we can be of service at any length of time. He was the one I could hear that day. I couldn't hear anyone else, who had longer than 30 days, maybe, because it just seemed so impossible at 3 days sober. There was so many God shots in the beginning. That was one thing that did deter me from coming into the program, was that word God, which I hear often. I remember being back home. It was just a few months before I got sober. I was visiting my best friend in Toronto. She had 2 years in the program, and I remember my only concern with staying with her is that I would be able to have wine, because I knew she was in the program, and I could see, I could see the difference in her life. However, I still, I was nowhere near what I thought. I was nowhere near getting sober. She was gone one day, and I remember picking up the big book from her shelf, opening it, and I saw the word God, and I immediately put it back on the shelf. I can't say what happened. I don't know what happened in the next 3 months that was any different from all the years before, except the desperation grew. I couldn't keep doing what I was doing anymore. And that word God, it didn't matter to me. I knew I needed help. And I became willing, and I became open. And today I do have a God of my own understanding. So again, I was plugged into the program. I went to a lot of meetings. I continue to go to a lot of meetings. I've always had a commitment. And my step work has been a very slow process and very thorough. There were so many steps on that. So many steps, on the scroll behind the speaker that I looked at, that I thought, no way. Self-supporting? No, I'm not never doing that. Making amends? No. Meditating? Absolutely not. I had grown up with meditation. I even had a meditation pillow when I was 6, and my dad was very much into yoga, and we lived on a commune at one point. There was a guru, and meditation when I came to the program, like, absolutely not. I had such a story behind it of why that didn't work for me. And the steps are in order for a reason. By the time I got to that amends part, I'm just jumping forward because I want to talk about the process of amends, because for me, the first time through, the most transformative step, absolutely all of them. The ninth step, however, was the turning point where I started to feel relief. where I started to feel the freedom that I heard about. And it's also the step where I have the most gripping fear about. And it's a really helpful reminder for me today that that fear, when I'm able to walk with it and through it, miracles happen on the other side. I started to make those amends, and it was really scary. I remember the first amends I ever made was Skylight Books bookstore in Los Angeles. I had stolen a Henry Rollins book, and I still had it to that day, 20 years later. I remember my sponsor said, start with the easiest amends, and I thought I chose that one. And I remember walking in there, and I remember talking with the owner, and I started to tell, you know, share with her, started to make my amends. And she said, oh, yeah, there's been lots of people like you come in. And I asked what I could do to make it right. And she said, buy a book. And that began my journey with amends. One of the hardest amends I had to make, or not had to, I had the spiritual opportunity. I like to call it a spiritual opportunity. I always laugh at that with my sponsor. I'm like, it's a spiritual opportunity. I had been working at a yoga studio many years before, and I would meet my dealer in the parking lot, Turtle, because Turtle and Casper. I think everyone who ever had a drug dealer must have had a Casper. And I would meet them in the parking lot next to Tony's Tailor while the women and men in the yoga studio would be doing meditation or, you know, doing yoga class. And these were really amazing women I was working for, these two women, beautiful women with just what they were creating with this yoga studio, the whole environment that they had, formed. And they had hired me, and I would go into the cash box and I would buy drugs with the money. And for many years after, when that job ended or I got fired for other reasons besides, probably because I wasn't showing up, I would drive by and I had so much shame. I would drive by that yoga studio and just cringe. I couldn't look that way. And that was for about 15 years. And time came that it was time to make amends when I got sober to that yoga studio. And I'll never forget, it took me a long time to I ended up getting a sober job at a pet food and supply store when I first got sober. I put a little bit of money of that minimum wage job aside for my amends. It took me quite a while to come up with half of what the estimate of what I needed to pay them back. And I never forget going to that yoga studio, and my knees were shaking. And I talked to the owner. I told her what I had done, that I was not the woman that I wanted to be at that time. And I can't remember the exact words. However, I handed her that money, and I said, I'd like to make a payment plan to pay the rest of this back, but this is a partial payment. And what else can I do to make this right? Right? Because it's not an apology, it's an amends. What action can I take to make this right? And she looked at me and she said, money is too easy. Would you be willing to come into the yoga studio to clean for 3 months? My knees almost buckled. It was the last thing I wanted to do. I just wanted to get out of there. My heart was racing. I didn't ever want to go back there. I never wanted to face her again. The shame and the, at that point, still the self-hatred about it all. And I looked at her, and because of the program, I said yes. And I remember driving away. And I was just in shock that I would need to go back there. And I'll never forget this. When I first got sober, my sponsor had me go to a rehab that had meetings at it called Friendly House. And I remember that by that point, I did have a sponsee, and I was meeting my sponsee there to do step work before the meeting. And I arrived, and I was crying. I was just shaking. And my sponsee hugged me And she was doing community hours, about 300, over 300 community hours to get a felony off her record. Now, the timing of that I had my little 3 months of cleaning to do, she had her 300 hours of community service. And at the same time, my sponsor also was doing community service. She had about 200 hours. Well, it wasn't amends, but it was a court-ordered amends. So here I was, sandwiched between these two women, my sponsor, my sponsee, and together we showed up for the hours that we needed to do. And compared to them, mine was very minimal. However, it was the fact that I was cushioned and we did it together. And I can't say we had a good attitude. We didn't. I had a bad attitude in it. I didn't want to clean. I had cleaned for a decade on meth. And going back to that yoga studio was just horrible, you know, and cleaning, you know, after the classes. However, we all did it. We took that contrary action. We took the next best indicated step. And we're all on the other side of that today. I now live 6 blocks from that yoga studio and I can drive by and put my head up. I don't feel shame. And I remember when I would clean the mirrors there and it would get foggy, you know, from the class. I would be cleaning them and I'd see myself, you know, in the reflection. And in the big book, it's talked about like we clear away the wreckage of our past. And that's what I was doing. I was literally cleaning away the wreckage of my past. If I had read that in a book, I would have thought that was the corniest thing ever, that scene with a woman, me, cleaning the mirrors, the symbolism in it. I am looking at the time and I realize how long I've talked. There's so much to talk about, so much to share. This program has changed my life. It's given me a life. My higher power, my sponsor always says, when I start to lose faith or be in gripping fear about something, she's like, Hannah, you've always been taken care of. And when I look at the evidence of that, it's true. I have a God box. And over the years, I've put in my fears in there and I've dated them. Once in a while, I like to go through that God box and look at them. Every single fear I had has been taken care of going back to 13 years. Not always, of course, rarely in the way or in the time that I saw, but in God's time. And God's time is, God's time is everything. And I'm going to share this before I close. My greatest fear, my very greatest fear ever since I was a little girl and well into the program was that my father would die. Of course he would. We all die. I would hear people talk about burying their parents, being there for them at the end of their life. And the thought of it, I would just, you know, I just knew I would fall apart and that I could never do that. My greatest fear happened last year. And also my greatest dream, and I don't share about the details of my dream often because I like to be anonymous in this. However, it is part of my story now. And that dream was to write a book, to write a memoir. And I had been trying to get that published for 5 years prior to when it was published last year. And I would get so frustrated. I would lose faith that it was going to happen, going to get out into the world. It was going to be on the shelves in bookstores that my story make it in print. It was a long journey. It took 10 years. And I share that because this ties into God's timing. My father also passed last year. So my greatest dream and my greatest fear happened within months of each other. I'm getting chills thinking of that right now. I couldn't have planned that. That's God's plan. That's God's timing. Talking about my father is still really hard. I share about it because the testament that we can get through anything in this program. Not that it's getting through, but I've stayed sober. I was able to be there. I'll never forget when I was on the 10 freeway in Los Angeles. I remember getting a call from my father. He kept calling, but then the phone would go blank. He called and finally got connected. And I still remember the spot I was on that freeway headed west to Santa Monica on a Saturday morning. And he said he was feeling disoriented. He was, I don't need to go into the details, but the next day, the doctor called and said, you need to come. He was admitted into the hospital, and I was there on a plane that morning. And I got to be there every step of the way. I got to bring him home with hospice. I got to hold his hand. And because of this program, I don't have one regret. I don't have one regret. I got to fly because of this program. I got to fly out there every other month for some years before that. It's because of all of you. Watching you show up. Watching you take direction. Trust God. Clean house. That's God's timing. It's interesting because sometimes, I'll talk to people and they'll be like, that's just terrible. Wow, your dad died and your book came out at the same, around the same time. I don't look at it that way. I don't choose to look at it that way. It was a death and a birth. Again, for anyone who is new to the program, stay. Take the next best indicated step. Grab onto someone. Put your hand into someone else's. And keep coming back. That woman 13 years ago, myself, who had 3 days, who didn't think she could do it. And I sit here today, these 13 years later. And I don't even think I've said this out loud before, but I do have a life beyond my wildest dreams. The internal life of a woman who can stand grounded with faith. Not always, but I know and I have the tools to come back to that place within myself. When I say wildest dreams, I don't mean a big house and a fancy car. But a woman who can sit with herself today, sober, and take another woman through the steps to become that woman that I always want to be, and to show them through the example that it's possible. Tara, thank you again for having me. Now I need to redo my makeup. And thank you.
Thank you, Hannah. It's another story of so much strength and courage and resilience and words of wisdom throughout the whole thing. It makes me want to redo mine. Like, wait a minute, mine was not positive enough. I need to redo it. It was really wonderful. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. I didn't think I'd be teared up the whole time.
Well, I'm happy to hear that because that means that you are bringing your authentic self, digging deep. I'm going to ask you a few questions. I was wondering what your sobriety looked like today, 13 years in, when it comes to how you work with your sponsor and how you maintain step 11.
Oh, I love that question. That is, So with my sponsor, it's very interesting that you asked that, because I've been with her for 12 years. She, you know, our lives get full. However, it's always been very important to me that I see my sponsor, that I talk to my sponsor. And she's been really busy, and so have I. It got to the point, however, where I really needed to tell her that I need to see her in person, because we had been meeting on Zoom and just doing, talking, and that I wanted to get back into, we had been started to read, or we're almost through now, but Drop the Rock, step 6 and 7. And so what it looks like today is I spoke up with her because I don't want my sobriety, I don't want my program to start to fall away. And I said, this is what I need, which for me was really hard because I know she's trying her best, but I also know that I need to ask for what I need. Yeah, well, I mean, that's just more new that I said this to her. So, well, you know, it's, okay, so I got a little sidetracked. So with my sponsor, we see each other twice a month. Personally, I would like more, but that's what she's able to give. And I call her more than those times. And then do you also say with my sponsees?
Oh, well, it was really,
about step 11.
Yeah, but before we get there, let me poke on that one. So how does she respond to you letting her know that you needed to go deeper?
She said that she has felt somewhat disconnected as well with her schedule, and that she is proud of me for speaking up and asking for what I need, because if I don't, then she doesn't know. We met for lunch last week, and she responded with options for me. And she said, this is what I can do. Yeah. 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 So we went back to where, when I first started working with her, we would go to this Greek restaurant, Papa Christos, once a week before meeting at Friendly House. And we hadn't been there in some years. So we met there last week. We went back to where we started. And then also continuing to read Drop the Rock. It's really interesting that you ask about prayer and meditation, because as I sit here, I just look at my desk and there's a book here at the top, a new book called Prayer and Meditation, the AA Grapevines. A few days ago, someone in the program had given me this. So it's really interesting that you ask. So with meditation for step 11, it is perhaps my favorite step. I can't believe I'm saying that, because when I did come into the program, it was my, in no way was I, as I shared in my lead, in no way was there going to be any meditation. And I love that this is a program of attraction rather than promotion. I started to see my best friend of 30 years had a meditation practice. I started to see what that looked like. I started to see something in her shift, and I became willing. Today I have a simple but very steady practice where I do a minimum of 6 minutes in the morning and then 6 minutes at night. Now, that's been going on for about 7 years. Oftentimes it's longer, especially in the evening. And I started out at 2 minutes. For me, it's not so much about the length, but it's about consistency and getting quiet and breathing. And what I've seen with meditation with step 11 is that it's allowed me to get closer to God, because it's created more pauses during the day, more gaps, more breath. When I'm pausing and when I'm breathing, taking in that breath, that for me is when there's opportunity to allow God in comes. The other thing with step 11, and you know, conscious contact with my God, is I experience that through other people in the program. That brings me closer to God when I hear the message through them.
It's a really beautiful answer. It really resonated with me how you explained the benefits of meditation and what that looks like in your life, those benefits, what they actually look like and feel like. I'm going to pivot and give you my condolences. Your father, your cousin's son, was that like a second cousin? And then your aunt's son. That's a lot of death, obviously for different reasons too, from the disease, and then your father. It's a lot of loss in a small period of time, and I'm really sorry for your loss.
Thank you. Thank you so much for that.
I'm also really, really proud of you getting your book published and being so relentless and steadfast. And I do look at it as a beautiful thing. I don't look at it as so sad, but I can see the irony of your biggest fear and your greatest dream coinciding in the same span of a few months.
Yeah. Yeah. And what that looks like to show up for both, right? Going through my father's things 2 weeks before I went on my book tour. Yeah.
Yeah. Is there anything you're thinking about now in your story or just popping in your head that you'd like to share? That was a funny thought to hear that one.
I'm just laughing because I was just elected secretary. So I had my first one last night and I haven't been secretary in a little while. And I'm just laughing because where God puts me and, you know, just the, I don't know why I'm laughing. I just, I guess gratitude. And what I'm thinking of right now is the fellowship last night, Friday night fellowship, which every single time I'm like, I'm not going to go. I'm going to go home tonight. Every Friday I end up going. I have a great time. I got to give a newcomer a ride home, talk about the program. Yeah, I'm not sure why I laughed, but it was a good one.
Okay, that's good. I think sometimes it's just from the little bit that you gave me, I'm putting little pieces together. It's just the irony of the program and the beauty of it. And it sounds like you have been taking active steps to do more. And then I happened to reach out to you. So for our listeners, I found you. I reached out to you and I was like, will you share? And you said yes. And now you're going to be a secretary of a meeting. You haven't done that for a while. You reached out to your sponsor and you're like, I want to do more. And it's just a magic.
Oh, yeah. And that's been throughout where I look at it and I'm like, oh, okay, what's going to nourish me, right? Because if I'm not in the program, if I'm not connected, when I'm starting to feel disconnected, oh, that's a signal, right? And I love that you said you were the one to reach out because it, you know, it does remind me that like with this, my dream having come out, I had done, you know, I have had the opportunity to share on at least 15 recovery podcasts and they've all come organically. They've all come through God. I haven't reached out. They've all just come organically and it's been another way of sharing sharing the story. That also does tie for me into the 11th step. With having my dream out there in the world, I can get very disconnected from God in that and start to look at the sales and where, you know, what am I getting out of this? What, you know, how is the book doing? And what brings me back is when I get quiet and I ask God, where can I best be of service? How can I share my message? Right? Because the book is about my journey and it's a memoir. And when I come to that place, there's this peace that comes, there's this ease that comes. And I think it's from that place that other things start to arise, right? Which is an example through you asking me to be here today.
Do you want, so two options, you can share the name of your book or we can have listeners reach out to me if they're if they want to look into it.
Yeah, the book is called Strip, a Memoir. And it's been very, very exciting having it out in the world, and particularly the connections that have been made from it.
So are we going to hear more about your childhood in the book? Because you gave like a really good teaser about how bohemian lifestyle, kidnapping, commune, and then this obvious deep love for your dad. Are we going to get to see all of that in the book?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm part of, because it's impossible to share everything in a share. So all of that is also in the book. And my journey in that, which has brought me to so many places today, but just the opportunities that have come from that in talking about these different aspects, right, of choices that I made when I was out there. Mm. And what that has also looked like. I mean, a big part of the book too is like, what does that look like, making a life away from that? How to, I've had many women reach out, like, how do you create a different life from that life? Mm. Which can be very hard.
Yeah. I can imagine. Switch gears here for your final question.
Yeah.
For the alcoholic listening with a little bit of time, what message would you like to leave with them? Only because you already left a message for the newcomers. You left a lot of messages for the newcomer. Normally, my final question is, what message for the newcomer would you like to leave? Feel free to reiterate. For the newcomer too.
Okay. Can you ask the question one more time?
Yeah. Okay. So final question, Hannah, what message would you like to leave for the newcomer or for those on the path of recovery? What final message would you like to leave for them?
Oh my goodness. Stay in the middle. Keep coming back. And I think the most important thing is to go towards the love. For me, that looks like connecting with other people, connection, and connection with my higher power, and all of that for me is possible having stayed in the middle, and staying in the middle through commitments, through service, all of it, and let someone know what's going on, speak the truth.
For more information, read the first 164 pages of The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous or visit keepcomingback.net.